So when they signed the new treaty, Maya was not at his side, not even in Borrow's, which was a relief in many ways, really. And yet he couldn't help but feel empty and cold in the chest. And certainly the others of the first hundred, at least, knew something had happened between them, again, which was infuriating, or so he told himself. They signed the thing in the same conference room in which they had hammered it out, with Helmut doing the honors with a big smile, and each delegate coming up in turn, in penguin suit or black evening gown, to say a few words for the cameras and then put their hand to the document, a gesture that only Frank seemed to see as bizarrely archaic, like scratching a petroglyph. Ridiculous. When it was his turn, he went up and said something about striking a balance, which was exactly it. He had arranged the competing interests to strike together at angles that matched their momentum exactly, arranging a traffic accident so that all the vehicles would collide into a single, solidified mass. The result was something not all that dissimilar to the previous version of the treaty, with both emigration and investment, the two main threats to the status quo, if there was such a thing on Mars, mostly blocked, and, this was the clever part, blocked by each other. It was a good piece of work, and he signed with a flourish. "For the United States of America," he announced emphatically, glaring around the world intently. That would play well on vid. So he strode through the subsequent parade with the cold satisfaction of work well done. The grass-floored tents and walk-tubes of the city were crowded with thousands of spectators, and the parade wound through them, wandering down the big canal-side tent with diversions up into the mesas, coming back down and crossing every canal bridge to cheers, and proceeding up to Princess Park for a great street party. The weather people had set for cool and crisp with brisk downslope winds. Kites dueled under the tent roofs like raptors, their colors bright against the dark pink afternoon sky. Frank found the party in the park unsettling. There were too many people watching him, too many who wanted to approach him and talk. That was fame. You talk to groups. So he turned around and walked back up the canal-side tent. Two parallel rows of white pillars ran down the side of the canal. Each pillar was a barrice column, semicircular at top and bottom, but with the half-circles rotated 180 degrees to each other. This simple maneuver created pillars that looked completely different, depending on where you were when you looked at them, and the two rows of these pillars had a strange tumble-down look, as if they were already ruins, although the smoothness and whiteness of their diamond-coated salt belied that. They stood off the grass as white as sugar cubes, and gleamed as if wet. Frank walked between the rows, touching each pillar in turn. Above them on each side, the valley slopes rose to the window-walled bluffs of mesas. Massed greenery shone behind these cliffs of untinted glass, so that it looked as if the city were rimmed by enormous terrariums. A really elegant ant farm. The part of the valley slope under tenting was dotted with trees and tile roofs, and cut by broad, grassy boulevards. The uncovered part was still a red, rocky plain. A great number of buildings were just being finished or still under construction. There were cranes everywhere rearing up toward the tent roofs, a kind of odd, colorful skeletal statuary. Also scores of scaffolded buildings, so that Helmut had said the tented hillsides reminded him of Switzerland. No surprise, since most of the construction was being done by Swiss. They scaffold a house to replace a window box. Sax Russell was standing at the foot of one of these scaffolded buildings, looking up at it critically. Frank turned and walked up a tube to him, said hello. "There's twice as much support as they need," Sax said. "Maybe more." "The Swiss like that." Sax nodded. They stared at the building. "Well," Frank said, "what do you think?" "The treaty?" "It will reduce support for terraforming," Sax said. "People are more inclined to invest than to give." Frank scowled. "Not all investment is good for terraforming, Sax. You have to remember that. A lot of that money is spent on other things entirely." But terraforming is a way to reduce overhead, you see. A certain percentage of the total investment will always be devoted to it, so I want the total as high as possible. Real benefits can only be calculated using real costs, Frank said. All the real costs. Terran economics never bothered to do that, but you're a scientist, and you should. You have to judge the environmental damage from higher population and activity, as well as the benefits to terraforming that go along with it. Better to up the investment devoted to pure terraforming rather than compromising and taking a percentage of a total that in some ways is working against you. Sachs twitched. It's funny to hear you speak against compromise after the last 4 months, Frank. Anyway, I say it's better to up both the total and the percentage. The environmental costs are negligible. Managed right, they can mostly be turned to benefits. An economy can be measured in terawatts or kilocalories, like John used to say. And that's energy, and we can use energy here in any form, even a lot of bodies. Bodies are just more work, very versatile, very energetic. Real costs, Sachs, all of them. You're still trying to play at economics, but it isn't like physics, it's like politics. Think what will happen when millions of displaced Terran emigrants arrive here, with all their viruses, biological and psychic. Maybe they'll all join Arcadi or Anne, ever thought of that? Epidemics running through the mob's body and mind. They could crash your whole system. Look, hasn't the Acheron group been trying to teach you biology? You should pay attention. This isn't mechanics, Sachs. It's ecology. And it's a fragile, managed ecology, so it has to be managed. Maybe, Sachs said. It was one of John's mannerisms, that phrase. Frank missed what Sachs was saying for a minute, then his attention was captured again. This treaty isn't going to make all that much difference anyway. The transnationals that want to invest will find a way. They'll make a new flag of convenience, and it'll look like a country staking its claim here, exactly according to the treaty's quotas. But behind it will be transnational money. There'll be all kinds of that stuff happening, Frank. You know how it is. Politics, right? Economics, right? Maybe, Frank said harshly, upset. He walked away. Later, he found himself in an upper valley district, still being built. The scaffolding was extreme, as Sachs had said, especially for Martian G. Some of it looked like it would be hard to bring down. He turned and looked out over the valley. The city was nicely placed, that was indisputable. The two sides of the valley meant there was going to be a lot visible from any point. Everywhere in town would have a view. Suddenly his wrist pad beeped and he answered. It was Anne staring up at him. "What do you want?" he snapped. "I suppose you think I sold you out, too. Let in the hordes to overrun your playground." She grimaced. "No. You did the best that could be done, given the situation. That's what I wanted to say." She clicked off, and his pad went blank. "Great," he said aloud. "I've got everyone on Two Worlds mad at me except Anne Claiborne." He laughed bitterly, took off walking. Back down to the canal and the rows of Barice columns. Lot's wives. There were knots of celebrants scattered over the canal-side sward, and in the late afternoon light their shadows were long. The sight took on a somehow ominous cast, and Frank turned, uncertain where to go. He didn't like the aftermath of things. Everything seemed finished, done, revealed as pointless. It was always this way. A group of Terrans were standing under one of the more magnificent new office blocks in the Niederdorf tent. There was Andy Jans among them. If Anne was pleased, Andy would be furious. Frank walked up to him, wanting to witness that. Andy saw him, and his face went still for a moment. "Frank Chalmers," he said. "What brings you down here?" His tone was amiable, but his eyes were unamused, even cold. Yes, he was angry. Frank, feeling better every second, said, "I'm just walking around, Andy, getting the blood flowing again. What about you?" After the briefest of hesitations, Jan said, "We're looking at office space." He watched as Frank digested the implications of the statement. His smile took on an edge, became a genuine smile. He went on, "These are friends of mine from Ethiopia, from Addis Ababa. We're thinking of moving our home office there next year, and so," his smile broadened, no doubt in response to the look on Frank's face, which Frank could feel hardening over the front of his skull, "we have a lot to discuss." Al-Kahira is the name for Mars in Arabic and Malaysian and Indonesian. The latter two languages got it from the former. Look at a globe, then, and see how far the Arabs' religion spread. The whole middle of the world from West Africa to the West Pacific, and most of that in a single century. Yes, it was an empire in its time, and like all empires, after death, it had a long half-life. The Arabs who live out of Arabia are called Majaris, and the Arabs who came to Mars, the Kahiran Majaris. When they arrived on Mars, a good number of them began to wander Vastatas Borealis, the northern Badia, and the Great Escarpment. These wanderers were mostly Bedouin Arabs, and they traveled in caravans, in a deliberate recreation of a life that had disappeared on Earth. People who had lived in cities all their lives went to Mars and moved around in rovers and tents. The excuses for their ceaseless travel included the hunt for metals, areology, and trade, but it seemed clear that the important thing was the travel, the life itself. Frank Chalmers joined old Zeyk Tukan's caravan a month after the treaty was signed, in the northern autumn of M-Year 15. July 2057. For a long time, he wandered with this caravan over the broken slopes of the Great Escarpment. He worked on his Arabic and helped with their mining and took meteorological observations. The caravan was composed of actual Bedouins from Aulad Ali, the western coast of Egypt. They had lived north of the area that the Egyptian government had named the New Valley Project. After a search for oil, discovered a water aquifer holding an amount equal to 1,000 years of the Nile's flow. Even before the discovery of the gerontological treatment, the Egyptian population problem had been severe. With 96% of the country desert and 99% of the population in the Nile Valley, it was inevitable that the hordes relocated in the New Valley Project would overwhelm the Bedouins and their entirely distinct culture. The Bedouins wouldn't even call themselves Egyptians, and despised the Nile Egyptians as spineless and immoral. But that did not keep the Egyptians from crowding north from the New Valley Project into Aulad Ali. Bedouins in the other Arab countries had taken the side of these overwhelmed outposts of their culture, and when the Arab Commonwealth started a Mars program and bought space on the continuous Earth-to-Mars shuttle fleet, they asked Egypt to give preference to their western Bedouins. The Egyptian government had been only too happy to oblige and clear the region of its troublesome minority. So here they were, Bedouins on Mars, wandering the world-wrapping northern desert. The weather observations piqued Frank's interest in climatology like none of the scientists' talk ever had. The weather on the escarpment was often violent, with katabatic winds rushing downslope and colliding with the Syrtis trade winds to create tall, fast red tornadoes or onslaughts of gritty hail. Currently, the atmosphere was at around 130 millibars in the summer, in a mix about 80% carbon dioxide and 10% oxygen, the remainder mostly nitrogen from the new nitrite conversion plants. It wasn't clear yet whether they were going to be able to overwhelm the CO2 with oxygen and the other gases, but Sachs seemed satisfied with their progress so far. Certainly on a windy day on the escarpment, it was clear that the air was thickening. It had some real heft to it. It threw heavy sand and darkened the afternoons to the color of a scab. And in the hardest gales, the gusts could knock you down quite easily. Frank timed one katabatic gust at 600 kilometers an hour, Luckily, it was part of such a hard general blow that everyone was in the Rovers when it happened. The caravan was a mobile mining operation. Metals and ore-bearing minerals were being discovered in all kinds of locations and concentrations on Mars, but one thing the Arab prospectors were discovering was that a lot of sulfides were very lightly scattered on the Great Escarpment and the flats immediately below it. Most of these deposits were in concentrations and total quantities that wouldn't justify the use of conventional mining methods, and so the Arabs were engaged in pioneering new extraction and processing procedures. They had built an array of mobile equipment, altering construction vehicles and exploration rovers to suit their purpose. The resulting machines were big, segmented, and distinctly insectile, looking like things out of a truck mechanic's nightmare. These creatures wandered the Great Escarpment in loose caravans, seeking the diffuse surface areas of stratiform copper deposits, preferably those with high amounts of tetrahedrite or chalcocite in them, so that they could recover silver as a byproduct of the copper. When they located one of these, they would stop for what they called the harvesting. While they did this, prospector rovers would range ahead along the escarpment on expeditions of a week or 10 days, following the old flows and rifts. When Frank had arrived, he had been welcomed by Zake, who told him to do whatever work he chose, so Frank commandeered one of the prospector rovers and took it out on solo expeditions. He would spend a week out puttering around on automatic search, reading the seismograph and the samplers and the weather instruments, doing an occasional boring, watching the skies. All over both worlds, Bedouin settlements looked drab from the outside. When they abandoned tents, their neighborhoods took on a windowless, thick-walled look, as if perpetually hunched over to protect themselves from the desert heat. Only when you got inside their homes did one see what was protected. The courtyards, the gardens, the fountains, the birds, the staircases, the mirrors, the arabesques. The Great Escarpment was strange country, cut by north-south canyon systems, marred by old craters, overrun by lava flows, broken into hummocks and karsts and mesas and ridges, and all of them on a steep slope, so that on top of any rock or prominence one could see far down to the north. In his days of solitary travel, Frank let the prospector program make most of the decisions and sat watching the land roll by, silent, stark, huge, torn like the dead past itself. Days would pass and the shadows wheel. The winds swirled upslope in the mornings and downslope in the late afternoons. Clouds stacked the sky, from low fog balls bouncing over the rocks to high cirrus shavings, with the occasional thunderhead spanning the whole distance, solid masses of cloud 20,000 meters high. Occasionally he would turn on the TV and watch the Arabic news channel. Sometimes in the silence of the mornings he would talk back to the TV. There was a part of him that was outraged at the stupidity of the media and of the events they packaged. The stupidity of the human race playing out its spectacle. Except that the vast bulk of humanity never appeared on video, never once in their lives, not even in the crowd scenes when a camera swept the mob. Back there, the Terran past still lived on in enormous regions where village life was plodding on as it always had. Maybe that was wisdom held to by old wives and shamans. Maybe. But it was hard to believe, because look what happened when they gathered in cities. Idiots on video. History in the making. One can say that the lengthening of human life must, by definition, be a great boon. These things made him laugh. "Haven't you ever heard of secondary effects, you asshole?" One night he watched a report on the fertilization of the Antarctic Ocean with iron dust, which was to act as a dietary supplement to phytoplankton, a population that was shrinking at an alarming rate for no obvious reason. The iron dust was dumped out of planes. It looked like they were fighting some kind of submarine fire. The project would cost $10 billion a year and would have to be continued in perpetuity. but it had been calculated that a century's worth of fertilization would reduce the global concentration of carbon dioxide by 15% plus or minus 10%, and given the ongoing warming and subsequent threat to the coastal cities, not to mention the death of most of the world's coral reefs, the project had been judged worth it. "Anne's gonna love this," Frank muttered. "Now they're terraforming Earth." Each vocal outburst he made untied a knot in his chest. He came to realize that no one was watching him. No one was listening. The tiny imaginary audience inside his head didn't exist. No one watches Our Life movies. No friend or enemy would ever know what he did here. He could do whatever he liked and normalcy be damned. Apparently this was what he had been craving, what he had instinctively sought. He could go out and kick stones down the side of a karst for a whole afternoon, or cry, or write aphorisms in the sand, or scream abuse at the moons careening across the southern sky. He could talk back to himself over meals. He could talk back to the TV. He could have conversations with his parents or his lost friends, with the president or John or Maya. He could dictate long, rambling entries into his lectern, bits of a sociobiological history of the world, a journal, a philosophical treatise, a pornographic novel. He could masturbate. An analysis of the Arab culture and their history. He did all these things, and when he and his prospector rolled back to the caravans, he would feel better, emptier, calmer, more truly hollow. "Live," as the Japanese said helpfully, "as if you were already dead." But the Japanese were aliens, and living with the Arabs sharpened his sense of how alien they were, too. Oh, they were part of 21st century humanity, no doubt about it. They were sophisticated scientists and technicians, cocooned like everyone else in a protective shell of technology at every moment of their lives, and busy making and watching their own life movies. And yet they prayed 3 to 6 times a day, bowing toward Earth when it was the morning or evening star. And the reason their techno-caravans gave them such great and obvious pleasure was because the caravans were an outward manifestation of this bending of the modern world to their ancient goals. "Man's work is to actualize God's will in history," Zake would say. "We can change the world in ways that help to actualize the divine pattern. It's always been our way. Islam says the desert does not remain desert. The mountain does not remain mountain. The world must be transformed into a semblance of the divine pattern, and that is what constitutes history in Islam. Al-Kahira gives us the same challenge as the old world, except in a purer form." He would say these things to Frank as they sat around in his rover in its tiny courtyard. These family rovers were transformed into private preserves, spaces that Frank was seldom invited into, and then only by Zake. Each time he visited, he was surprised anew. The rover was nondescript from the exterior, big, with darkened windows, one of several parked in a bunch, with walk tubes between them. But then one ducked through a doorway and inside and stepped into space filled with sunlight pouring down through skylights, illuminating couches and elaborate rugs, tiled floors, green-leafed plants, bowls of fruit, a window with the Martian view tinted and framed like a photo, low couches, silver coffee urns, computer consoles of inlaid teak and mahogany, running water in pools and fountains. A cool, wet world, green and white, intimate and small. Looking around, Frank had the powerful sensation that rooms like this had existed for centuries, that the chamber would be instantly recognized for what it was by people living in the empty quarter in the 10th century, or across Asia in the 12th. Often Zake's invitations would come in the afternoon, when a group of men would convene in his rover for coffee and talk. Frank would sit in his spot near Zake and sip his muddy coffee and listen to the Arabic with all the attention he could muster. It was a beautiful language, musical and intensely metaphoric, so that all their modern technical terminology resonated with desert imagery because of the root meanings of all the new words, which, like most of their abstract terms, had concrete physical origins. Arabic, like Greek, had been a scientific language early on. And this showed in many unexpected cognates with English and in the organic and compact nature of the vocabulary. The conversations ran all over, but they were guided by Zeke and the other elders, who were deferred to by the younger men in a way Frank found incredible. Many times the conversation became an overt lesson for Frank on Bedouin ways, which allowed him to nod and ask questions, and occasionally to offer comments or criticism. "When you have a strong conservative streak in your society," Zeke would say, "which detaches itself from the progressive streak, that's when you get the worst kinds of civil wars. As in the conflict in Colombia that they called La Violencia, for instance. A civil war that became a complete breakdown of the state. A chaos that no one could understand, much less control."
"Or like Beirut," said Frank innocently.
"No, no," Zeke smiled. "Beirut was much more complex than that. It was not only civil war, but also a number of exterior wars impinging on it. It was not a matter of social or religious conservatives detaching from the normal progress of culture, as in Colombia or the Spanish Civil War."
"Spoken like a true progressive."
"All Kahiran Majaris are progressive by definition, or we would not be here. But Islam has avoided civil war by remaining a whole. We have a coherent culture, so that the Arabs here are still devout. This is understood even by the most conservative elements back home. We will never have civil war, because we are united by our faith." Frank let his expression alone speak the fact of the Shiite heresy among many other Islamic civil wars. Zeke understood the expression, but ignored it and forged on. "We all move together through history. One loose caravan. You could say that we here on Al-Kahira are like one of our prospecting rovers, and you know what a pleasure it is to be in one of those." "So?" Frank thought hard about how to word his question. His inexperience with Arabic would only give him a certain amount of leeway before they got offended. "Is there really the idea of social progress in Islam?" "Oh, certainly." Several of them had replied in the affirmative and were nodding still. Zeke said, "Don't you think so?" "Well," Frank let it pass. There still wasn't a single Arab democracy. It was a hierarchical culture with a premium put on honor and freedom, and for the many who were low down in the hierarchy, honor and freedom were only achievable by deference, which reinforced the system and held it static. What could he say? "The destruction of Beirut was a disaster for progressive Arab culture," another man said. "It was the city where intellectuals and artists and radicals went when they were attacked by their local governments. The national governments all hated the pan-Arab ideal, but the fact is we speak one language across these several countries, and language is a powerful unifier of culture, along with Islam. It makes us one, really, despite the political borders. Beirut was always the place to affirm that position, and when the Israelis destroyed it, that affirmation became more difficult. The destruction was calculated to splinter us, and it did. So here we begin the work again." And that was their social progress. The stratiform copper deposit that they had been raking up ran dry, and it was time for another Rala, the movement of the Hijra, to the next site. They traveled 2 days and arrived at another stratiform deposit that Frank had found. Frank went out again on another prospecting trip. For days he sat in the driver's seat, feet on the dash, watching the land roll by. They were in a region of Thuleya, or little ribs, parallel ridges running downslope. He never turned on the TV anymore. There was a lot to think about. "The Arabs don't believe in original sin," he wrote in his lectern. "They believe that man is innocent and death natural.
that we do not need a savior. There is no heaven or hell, but only reward and punishment which take the form of this life itself and how it is lived. It is a human correction of Judaism and Christianity in that sense. Although in another sense they have always refused to take responsibility for their destiny, it's always Allah's will. I don't understand that contradiction, but now they are here. And the Majaris have always been an intimate part of Arab culture, often its leading edge. Arabic poetry was revived in the 20th century by poets who actually lived in New York or Latin America. Perhaps it will be the same here. It's surprising to find how much their vision of history corresponds to what Boone believed. I don't think either understood that at all. Very few people ever bother to find out what other people really think. They're willing to accept whatever they're told about anyone sufficiently distant. He came on a find of porphyry copper, unusually dense, and with high concentrations of silver in it as well. That would be welcome. Copper and silver were both only somewhat scarce metals on Earth. But silver was used in massive quantities in a great number of industries, and they were running low on easy sources of it. And here was more of it, right on the surface, in good concentrations. Not as much as in Silver Mountain on the Elysium Massif, of course, but the Arabs wouldn't care. Harvest it, and then they would get to move again. He moved on himself. Days passed, the shadows wheeled. The wind went downslope, upslope, downslope, upslope. Clouds formed and storms broke, and sometimes the sky was spangled with ice bows and sun dogs and dust devils made of hail, sparkling like mica in the pink sunlight. Sometimes he would see one of the aero-breaking continuous shuttles, like a blazing meteor running steadily across the sky. One clear morning he saw Elysium Montes bulking over the horizon like a black Himalaya. The view had been bent 1,000 kilometers over the horizon by an inversion layer in the atmosphere. He stopped turning on the lectern as he had the TV. Nothing but the world and him. Winds caught at the sand and tossed clouds of it against the rover. Kala, the empty land. But then dreams began to plague him, dreams that were memories, intense and full and accurate, as if he were reliving his past while he slept. One night he dreamed of the day he had found out for sure that he would lead the American half of the first Martian colony. He had driven from Washington out to the Shenandoah Valley, feeling very odd. He walked for a long time in the Great Eastern Hardwood Forest. He came on the limestone caves at Luray, now a tourist attraction. And on a whim, he took the tour. Every stalactite and stalagmite was lit by lurid, colored lights. Some had had mallets attached to them, and an organist could play them like the plates of a glockenspiel, the well-tempered cavern. He had to walk out into the peripheral blackness and stuff his sleeve in his mouth so the other tourists wouldn't hear him laugh. Then he parked in a scenic overlook and walked off into the forest and sat down between the roots of a big tree. No one around, a warm fall night, the earth dark and furry with trees. Cicadas cycling through their alien hum, crickets creaking their last mournful creaks, sensing the frost that would kill them. He felt so odd. Could he really leave this world behind? Sitting there on the earth, he had wished he could slide down a crack like a changeling and reemerge something else, something better, something mighty. Noble, long-lived, something like a tree. But nothing happened, of course. He lay on the ground, cut off from it already. A Martian already. And he woke and was disturbed all the rest of that day. And then, even worse, he dreamed of John. He dreamed of the night he had sat in Washington and watched John on TV stepping out onto Mars for the first time, closely followed by the other three. Frank left the official celebration at NASA and walked the streets, a hot D.C. night, summer of 2020. It had been part of his plan for John to make the first landing. He had given it to him as one sacrifices a queen in chess, because that first crew would be fried by the Voyager's radiation and, according to the regs, grounded for good on their return. and then the field would be cleared for the next trip out, for the colonists who would stay for good. That was the real game, and that was the one Frank planned to lead. Still, on that historic night, he found himself in a foul mood. He went back to his apartment near DuPont Circle, and then went out and lost his FBI tag, and slipped into a dark bar, and sat there watching the TV over the bartenders' heads, drinking bourbon like his father, with Martian light pouring out of the TV and reddening the whole dark room. And as he got drunk and listened to John's inane talk, his mood got worse and worse. It was hard to focus on his plan. He drank hard. The bar was noisy, the crowd inattentive. Not that the landing hadn't been noticed, but here it was just another entertainment, on a par with the bullets game that one bartender kept cutting to. Then, blip, back to the scene on Crisi Planitia. The man next to him swore at the switch. "Basketball's gonna be a hell of a game on Mars," Frank said. "Have to move the hoop up, or they be breaking their heads." "Sure, but think of the jumps. 20-foot dunks easy." "Yeah, even you white boys'll jump high there, or so you say. But you better leave the basket alone, or you got the same trouble you got here." Frank laughed, but outside it was hot, a muggy D.C. summer night, and he walked home in a plummeting foul mood, blacker and blacker with every step. And coming upon one of DuPont's beggars, he pulled out a $10 bill and threw it at the man, and as the bum reached for it, Frank shoved him away, shouting, "Fuck you! Get a job!" But then people came up out of the metro, and he hurried off, shocked and furious. Beggars slumped in the doorways. There were people on Mars, and there were beggars in the streets of the nation's capital, and all the lawyers walked by them every day, their freedom and justice talk no more than a cover for their greed. "We're gonna do it different on Mars," Frank said viciously, and all of a sudden he wanted to be there immediately. No careful years of waiting, of campaigning. "Get a fucking job!" he shouted at another homeless man. Then on to his apartment building, with its bored security team behind the foyer desk, people wasting their whole lives sitting there doing nothing. Upstairs, his hands shook so hard that he couldn't at first get his door open, and once inside he stood frozen, horrified at the sight of all the bland executive's furniture, all of it a theater set, built to impress infrequent visitors. Really, just NASA and the FBI. None of it his. Nothing his. Nothing but a plan. And then he woke up, alone, in a rover on the Great Escarpment.